Thank you very much.
Okay. So thank you again, Robin and Adrian, for organizing this nice program that has kept me busy and quite informed about what's going on the past week. So what I'm talking about is somewhat, again, off the current schedule. It has nothing to do with virus assembly. And it arose from actually a talk that Shura Grossberg gave a couple of weeks ago, and then there were some issues of anomalous diffusion, anomalous transport that came up, and Robin said, why don't you explain some of that stuff? I'm going to talk about the context in which this non-diffusive transport occurs, which is a polymer trying to make its way through a nanopore. This could be DNA or something else.
Or RNA going
through a capsid. And
more voltage applied?
There might very well be a voltage.
Okay, so I'll give a very brief introduction, given that Shura had explained the essence of the problem, but for those of you who missed his nice talk. And then I will go and describe how people think about this problem in the framework of what I call Brownian translocation, which is like one of these reaction coordinate types of approaches that people also were talking about in the context of virus assembly. And I'll show that the fact that essentially what you have is a polymer that is trying to go through the hole introduces some polymeric aspects that are kind of many body degrees of freedom that causes the transport to be not simple and diffusive. And I'll describe how that differs in the cases where, as people were asking, there's either a voltage bias or there isn't, and whether or not the asymmetry in the DNA or any other molecule that has some kind of chirality in it could change things. And at the end, if you are interested, I'm perfectly prepared or happy to sort of talk about things such as fractional diffusion equations, how they arise, and what they mean. Yes?
Is it possible to turn off the
blackboard? Absolutely. So that's in the category of good questions.
With a clear answer.
So, as Robin was saying, potentially the only potential connection between what I'm talking about and viruses is that the passage of a long polymer through a pore, one of the cases that it arises would be, say, a viral RNA trying to be injected inside the nucleus or into the cell through some kind of a pore. But more specifically, the situation that I would like to discuss is this set of experiments that have been performed by this group and also Amit Meller later on, where they have a pore in a membrane. The pore is alpha hemolysin. They give a typical dimensions of it here that is of the order of 18 angstroms. And it is big enough for single-stranded but not double-stranded DNA to pass through. And basically what they do is they apply a voltage across the membrane. And this voltage sucks in the DNA, and once it puts its head through the pore, suddenly the pore is blocked and the normal passage of ions through the pore cannot take place, and the current that is being monitored drops down to some smaller value. And then as long as the pore is blocked, presumably the time that the polymer is in the pore, the current is at small value, and then once the polymer has been pulled either through or gone back to the site that it started, the current goes back to where it was. And so by monitoring the duration of these blockage times, they can get an idea for how long it takes for the polymer to so-called translocate through the pore. Now, this nice cartoon here is introduced to show you this process. Basically, the polymer is being pulled through the pore, and once it is being while it is being pulled, the current drops down. And what they show on the left, on the right, is that they can use electronics such that at the moment that the current has dropped and you know that the polymer is in the pore, they switch off the voltage. So the difference between the translocation on the left and on the right is that on the left, as the polymer is in the pore, it is actively being pulled through by the potential difference, whereas on the right, while it is inside the pore, the potential has been turned off, so it is freely diffusing in some sense back and forth. Of course, the reason that they are doing this, and a number of groups are working on this problem, is the hope that by monitoring the current, one can have some way of sequencing the DNA as it is being pulled through. But that hope is presumably sometime far away. The connection to that goal that I would like to ask is, suppose you achieve some means of being able to differentiate between the different bases that are being pulled through the pore, how does the time that it takes to read off a polymer depend on the length of DNA? If you were to make the DNA that you are pulling through 10 times longer, would you be able to do this process of read-off in a time that is only 10 times longer, or is there some other scaling going on? So basically, I'm only going to focus on this issue of scaling. And
so when you say 10 times longer, do you mean this trick of multiplying each base by 10, or do you mean actually having a 10 times longer piece of DNA and
look at it? 10 times longer piece of. So basically, then the issue arises of what's the best strategy. Do you want to chop things off and then do them piece by piece, or have a long one that one you want to through? So what I'm asking is, if you have a very long one, how does the characteristic time scale with the length? So good, useful scaling concept for a polymer physicist to think about. Okay? So how do people approach this problem? Well, you start with the polymer completely on one side, and as it is being through, you have intermediate states where there are, say, S monomers on one side, and if the total length is N, N minus S monomers on the other side. And so a good way, presumably, to follow, if you want to think of this as a reaction, is to introduce a reaction coordinate or translocation coordinate, which is how many monomers you have on one side. And so as this thing goes through, this coordinate S starts from zero and goes all the way to N, and then you know that the whole thing has gone through. So
it might be a very trivial question, but is there a case where the middle monomers enter the bottom?
These are only strands that you know whose length they
But what happens if the monomer, one of the monomers in the middle of the DNA gets stuck to the pole? It cannot enter, but it doesn't leave because of the electric field. Does it happen?
He's discussing diffusion.
For the four bases that are involved, there's not, in this alpha hemolysin channel, there's not a situation where it's sticking so strongly, as far as I understand.
I think he's worried about not having the end come in, but having come in.
Oh, come in like this.
Oh, you mean
no room really for it.
Entering like a hairpin. Okay.
So
it's not seen yet.
Could you mention two ends go in and you leave a hairpin behind and can't get through? Is that you mentioned?
I guess this, in principle, for some particular pore and polymer would be a possibility. I imagine for DNA, one thing that would prevent it would be that it would be very hard to bend it. But for some general flexible enough polymer and some sufficiently big size, maybe that is a worry. Okay? So the way that people approach this problem, and this is a list of people, originally Song and Park, Motukemar, Lubensky and Nelson, is to say that if the passage of the monomer through the polymer is very if this process is very slow, such that at each instant of time, you can assume that the polymers on the two sides have time to reach equilibrium, then the process for following up this coordinate S as it changes in time is as follows. What you do is, assuming equilibrium, you calculate what the free energy of one of these intermediate states is, where you have S monomers on one side and minus S monomers on the other side. So there's the free energy as a function of S. Once you have the free energy as a function of S, you say that when S changes, there is a change in free energy, and that change in free energy provides a bias or a force that derives the changes in S. So along the lines of Brownian motion, what you write down is that the change of this coordinate S with time is proportional to the variations of this free energy as this coordinate S changes. There is some mobility or constant of proportionality that we don't know what it is, but let's give it the symbol mu. And this process is also stochastic because it is in a random thermal environment and presumably subject to some kind of a fluctuating force in time, if you like. Okay? So one aspect of this problem that people emphasized is that when you look at the free energy as a function of this coordinate S, just the entropic degrees of freedom give you some kind of a barrier, because the free energy as a function of the coordinate S has this form. It has log S, log N minus S, which you can very easily get by thinking about the number of configurations of a polymer close to a wall has a 1 over S to the 1/2 behavior in it. You multiply two of them, that's the entropy, and then you take the logarithm, and that's the contribution to free energy. This constant G, which is 1/2 if we think about random walks, is slightly modified if you include the self-avoiding nature of the polymer, but essentially the nature of the entropic potential is in this form. And essentially says that when the polymer is halfway through, it has the fewest number of configurations to fluctuate compared to when it is entirely on one side or the other side, so there is a small entropic barrier. And so given that and this formalism, the way that you calculate the distribution of times for the polymer to start at one end, let's say this end to the left is S equals to 0, and go all the way to the other end, S equals to N. So this axis has been scaled by 1 over N, goes between 0 and 1. What is plotted here is this entropic potential. Basically, it has the fewest number of configurations, like in the middle. It is symmetric. And this infinite wall here is placed so that we calculate the time that the particle takes to go from one end to the other end, neglecting situations where the polymer just goes in and then comes out. So basically, by placing an infinite wall here, you can just look at configurations that escape from this potential. And the formalism for doing so was developed by Kramer in 1940. Basically, the probability satisfies a Fokker-Planck equation, and you put your free energy and you calculate what this probability is, and from the probability with appropriate boundary condition, you can calculate the distribution and the average value of the escape time. But rather than doing that, just note that if we start with a potential that is logarithmic, and you take one derivative of it to get a force, it goes like 1 over s. Here I have to take another derivative, it goes like 1 over s squared. The diffusion term dimensionally goes like 1 over s squared. So basically both terms in this equation have dimensions of 1 over s squared. And even without knowing anything about the solution to this equation, you can see that you can scale s by factor of n, time by a factor of s squared, which is n squared, and then you have some dimensionless equation. So we don't need to know anything about solving this equation. Just on dimensional ground, you know that the characteristic times for this problem are going to scale like length squared.
This is diffusion time, not translocation time.
This is mean first passage or escape time.
Escape time.
Yeah, which is... Well, there is the entropic force, so you go over this barrier.
But no pulling.
No pulling, no. Right. So basically, yeah. So if you were to completely ignore the entropic barrier, it goes like 1/2 n squared over d. If you include the barrier, it goes like 0.6 n squared over d. What's 10% between friends? What I'm interested is this n squared behavior. So if you make the polymer 10 times longer, you would say it takes 100 times longer to diffuse through without a force.
This doesn't contain problems like the hydrodynamic effects of getting rid of the water which is enclosed in the coils.
Right. This is basically the process that I set up for you. As long as at each stage you are in equilibrium, you are fine.
So it goes really slowly.
Yeah. Well, what does that mean? Okay.
So you also don't address how the polymer finds the pore in the first place.
No. No. Once it is...
It's a critical part of the whole process.
Yes, that's true. So there's another time. The point is that time probably depends on concentration and is independent or vaguely dependent on the length of the polymer. So if for some obscure reason of my background, all I'm focused on are scaling phenomena, this is the part that I go and look at.
Well, experimentally, they have a field and they drive the polymer in and then they turn the field off and let it diffuse.
Oh. Yeah, no, I mean, that's what Dan Brunson did, but in general terms, the critical point is how does the end of the polymer get to the pore?
No, the rate of capture is 1,000 times smaller than diffusion limited rate. So the rate of capture is limited by barrier, which DNA overcomes when it sticks in. So diffusion time is very small.
The electrical field lines run through it, and as electrical field is on, it will stretch the DNA so it cuts in quite easily, and then you turn it off, and then you're...
But that's starting the process off. Yeah. I was talking in a more general situation.
If there's no field, it will never get in.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so here's the puzzle I'd like you to think about. So I just convinced you that if we have this unbiased passage of DNA through this pore and it has length n, the time scales like n squared. Now, any reasonable person would say that if I were to remove this barrier completely, the time for the polymer to go the same distance should suddenly be much faster. Well, let's calculate that according to what we know about polymer theory. Basically, in the process, this polymer has typically moved a distance that is of the order of the typical size or the typical radius that it would assume in the solution. That typical radius grows with the number of monomers in another scaling law characterized by an exponent nu, so that the typical distance squared is n to the 2 nu, where nu in three dimensions is known to be something like 0.6. In two dimensions, it is 3/4. It is in any case larger than 1/2, so that this n to the 2 nu is larger than 1. Now, a polymer in solution, if it has n monomers, well, if a polymer has n monomers and it is executing Brownian type of motion, what is called Rouse dynamics, then its diffusivity scales like 1 over n. The larger it is, the slower it will diffuse. So you would say that the time that it would take for it to diffuse a distance that is of the order of its own radius is r squared over d. R squared goes like n to the 2 nu, d goes like n 1 over n, so it should go like n to the 1 plus 2 nu. As I said, nu is greater than 1 half, so this time scales asymptotically with an exponent that is larger than 2, meaning that you have something that is counterintuitive. We remove the barrier, and if everything that is given here is correct, removing the barrier makes it move faster. So what...
Just hold on, both sides are out.
Pardon?
You're assuming that it's out.
Yes, both, that's right, yes.
It's not, here's the current solution.
No, but it's...
But in the model it's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Now,
so...
What did you assume for the diffusion constant on the left side? You just took it to be something zero.
This diffusion constant on the left side is essentially the monomers going through the pore.
The coefficient will be different, but production of any will always remain.
Yeah. I guess what Ajay is asking is why do I assume this parameter to be independent of n?
Okay.
Because it's local, it has doesn't know. Yeah.
You wanted us to keep in mind the argument, the number of configurations on the two sides of the driving force for the pore case.
Actually, what I would like to tell you is that this inconsistency, what it tells you, is that the polymer, because of all of the different degrees of freedom that the polymer has, in order for it to relax, it takes a long time. The amount of time that it takes grows with n. And I said that this original formulation is only going to work if you have the two sides being in equilibrium. So basically, we see that as we make the polymer longer and longer, we will reach a point at which the assumption that the two sides have sufficient time to reach equilibrium so that this formulation is valid is internally inconsistent.
Not in Gaussian case, it's going to be still a case.
But, yeah.
In Gaussian case, they both scale the same.
Right, because nu is 1 half, yes. But even then, there are logs and things like that. Okay? So I guess the point is, if you want to use this local equilibrium, well, you have to make sure at the end of the day that you were in equilibrium, and we see that for a long enough polymer, that's never going to be the case. Okay?
Isn't the problem that with the pore, you're keeping the center point fixed, and you're allowing the two ends to come to equilibrium with that boundary condition?
Yes.
When the pore is absent, that boundary condition no longer exists.
That's right. Yeah, so, but the point is, well, no. What I'm saying is that this answer is the correct answer, that the previous formulation with the assuming equilibrium at all times is not consistent. It's an internally inconsistent assumption.
Could we think that if the stepping time is at all rapid, then
yeah,
there'll never be a full experiencing or a full partition on both sides?
Yeah.
So that's maybe right. Not don't have to wait for so long. It's such a long polymer. Maybe just by moving over by one base.
Yes.
You have to do your whole ensemble average over again.
Yeah.
Surely you can move one base quicker than doing a whole ensemble average, even if it's not
a scale like n in some
even
fashion.
If it's not a very long ring line. Yeah.
Okay, so one I will grant you, but yeah. Now let's do 1/10 of the polymer.
Okay, yeah.
You pull 1/10 of the polymer through, you want the 9/10 that is left to equilibrate.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
and that's a long time. Yeah. So essentially another way of thinking about it, if you want pictures, etc., is that the typical assumptions that people would have is that when you're pulling this thing through, it is kind of a good, nice process, forgetting about what the polymer has to do on the two sides. And the polymer has to relax, not get entangled, not form knots. It has a lot of those constraints to worry about. And so one has to start thinking about it.
Okay.
Okay. So, given that we knew that this other approach, the theoretical approach, was inconsistent, and not knowing any other theoretical formalism, we went and did a numerical simulation. So basically, because two dimension was simpler and would give us more scaling range, we did the simulations for a self-avoiding polymer in two dimensions. We introduced some kind of a wall and some polymer that was essentially a set of balls that were connected to each other, and some set of constraints about how close the balls can come to each other, etc., to make it self-avoiding. So with this model, you can do Monte Carlo and simulate fairly long polymers. And for these long polymers, we calculated what the typical translocation time was. We also calculated this other time, which was the time that the polymer would take to equilibrate or diffuse its own radius of gyration. They're supposed to be more or less the same thing. And what is plotted here is the ratio of those two times. And basically, the only thing that you are supposed to get from this is that asymptotically for large polymer lengths, this ratio appears to saturate to a constant. That is basically roughly the typical translocation times are of the order in our model 12 times longer than the distance that the time it would take the polymer to diffuse its own distance. So the factor of 12 or whatever it is definitely dependent on the fact of our choosing a particular shape for our pore and a particular set of rules for our polymer. But what I think is the case is that the ratio of these two times will be constant, and therefore the scaling of the translocation time is the same as the scaling of the time that it would take the polymer to relax in solution, which is longer than n squared. It is n to the this 2 nu plus 1.
Sorry, what happened to mu?
Mu, the mobility that we had for the object.
Won't that enter here?
That description was a phenomenological description for the reaction coordinate.
No, but the
this is Rouse dynamics. These are, yeah.
The mu assumes local thermal.
Right. But what I guess the discussion. Yes.
Yeah, it says the STT is mu the FW.
Okay, so that particular form of mu, but there's still some mobility associated with.
A B, that's the Rouse
model. Yeah. It's some constant. So basically in Monte Carlo, you have some set of rules for picking a ball and moving it to some particular distance. And you can, if you apply a force, therefore it would move with some constant velocity, the ratio of them would give you some kind of
mean. Some sort of real, you know, interaction with the walls and the
here basically we are.
Yeah.
We have only hard balls, so everything that we see in our simulations is entirely entropic in origin.
As a matter of principle, as far as we understand Fred's question, matter of principle, the friction with the walls and these local properties will enter into the prefactor.
Of course.
And it'll break that ratio.
Yes. I emphasize this ratio is entirely our model dependent. The only thing that I would like to say is that the scaling.
Mm-hmm. It will. Yeah. Well, that ratio is in front of single end term, and the friction is for the whole chain. So is there any physical argument why? Because from this little interval, it's very hard to say whether it saturates or not. Do you have any physical argument why this ratio should be a constant? Because it's, from this data, it's not maybe convincing, but not.
No. Yeah, we have no other argument except the bound that I provide.
Basically, what you're talking about, you have a local friction.
Yeah.
And you're talking about effectively diffusion along one dimensional chain.
Right.
With local friction, which is your translocation model.
Yeah.
And the other problem is full Rouse, which is friction at every beat.
Yeah.
And so I don't see why, if you have different quantitative scales in way in general.
Well, we had no theoretical reason to believe that. That's why we did the simulation.
Yeah.
And other people have repeated this and gotten the same answer. So, but indeed, it's a good question as to what this coefficient is. Right. And some people have developed, I'm not sure to what extent I believe them, some finite size scaling theories for the dependence of this ratio on the size of the whole. So you can.
Everything is for Rouse.
Yeah, everything is for Rouse. And I guess the other thing that you are getting at is that when you have polymer in solution, you have hydrodynamic interactions. And for hydrodynamic interactions, the mobility doesn't scale as 1 over n, but as 1 over r. And so some of these scaling laws that I have given would in principle change. It's a difficult problem because one thing that I'm not sure is to what extent you will be able to continue the standard Rouse description when you bring your polymer close to a wall and next to a hole. So there's a number of theoretical issues to worry about when you introduce hydrodynamics into this problem.
Yeah. Hydrodynamic fluctuations also might give kind of strong fluctuations to the pore, quite even when there isn't a chain. And the chain might be dragged along back and forth by these hydrodynamic fluctuations, and you might have to include it in your dynamics.
Well, that, if you are away from the pore, you mean the dynamics of the pore itself?
Expect that
inside the pore.
Fluctuations will cause hydrodynamic flow back and forth to the pore.
That's yet another issue. I mean, do you want to extend it to pores that are large enough so that you would believe hydrodynamic equations within your pore? You would need to use some kind of discretized version. And so there's a whole set of issues when you want to introduce hydrodynamics. So this is just to indicate that this problem has anomalous dynamics. And again, to sort of make that more precise,
you can use a theory in the previous page, and you have to estimate where the crossover between another, what is the value of n you would get for your model?
It would depend on what I choose for the two coefficients.
For this parameter, you choose for your model, where would be that n in? When wrong in the previous
page. We didn't do that because what we need to do would be to increase or decrease the size of the pore so much so that we come to the regime that is slow enough and we can see and estimate what the mobilities are. And this kind of ran against our sort of trying to get to the scaling regime as quickly as possible. So what you say is indeed possible, but one needs to do more simulations. We didn't do that.
Do you understand why at larger polymer lengths, with a smooth volume, it seems to get a little bit more efficient? There's a drop in the ratio.
We have been worrying about all of these things, such as why, for example, you have such a large number for the crossover ratio and such things. And we have no understanding for that large number, this kind of shape, and things like that.
Why one of them is increasing, another is decreasing?
Exactly. Yeah.
Pushes different, I thought from different sides.
Well, no, one of them is actually this. This is really the one that you should be looking at. This other one is for a phantom polymer.
Which is, what's wrong with that?
No, the phantom polymer is the black one. The other one is for the smooth volume.
Oh, okay, yes, right. So, that's right. So why for the excluded volume you have this? Okay, we have now. Okay, so, yes.
Just in a completely different direction. Are you having diffusion is just unidirectional?
No. It's both directions. So there is nothing pulling this. So this is unbiased. Next transparency, I'll do the biased version where you are actively pulling from one side.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you put a kind of a potential to catch only the guys that go through all the way.
In the simulations, what we did is essentially we prevented we started with the first monomer on one side, the rest of the monomer equilibrated on the other side, and the rule was that the first monomer could never go to the other side. That's all.
I think that was the nature of the question there.
I'm happy either way. So long as when you're halfway through, you are going back and forth.
Yeah.
And indeed.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And indeed, that's the next point. Let's imagine that you are halfway through. And so when you are halfway through, you have no bias to the right or to the left except for this endpoint condition. And so presumably your coordinate S is basically going back and forth, executing some kind of fluctuation, some kind of a random walk. Now, if that was like a random walk, by a time that was of the order of n squared, it would reach one end or the other. The fact that it takes longer means that the typical fluctuations that you have are not diffusive. That's where the word anomalous comes from. And what that means is that if you look at the fluctuations in that coordinate S as a function of time, the average is of course zero, the average squared will not go linearly in t, but t to some other power that is less than one. And the way to find what this power is, essentially you have to say that by the time that we know is the translocation time and scales like n to the power of 1 plus 2 nu, delta s squared should be n squared. You match those two and you find the exponent should be something that is less than 1. And in particular, for the case of 3 dimensions, the exponent would be predicted to be 0.46. And for the case of 2 dimensions, which is our simulations, the exponent would be 0.4 rather than 0.5, which is the random walk. And we can check that in our simulations also. And clearly for short polymers, we don't have that much range to follow this kind of scaling regime. As we go to longer and longer polymers, we have more range to follow the fluctuations of something in the center. And we can extract delta S squared as a function of T, and the fit is to this predicted power of 4/5. Okay? So the fluctuations of this coordinate, if it is unbiased, will not be diffusive, they are subdiffusive.
Diffusive for phantom?
For phantom, so again, the exponent, the formula is 1 over 1 plus 2 nu. Put nu equals to 1/2, it would indeed be diffuse. Okay. Now, what this thing is related to is something that was reasonably well known, or is reasonably well known in the polymer community, which is, suppose you have a polymer and you color one of the monomers, and then you follow essentially this tagged monomer as a function of time. At very, very long time, the whole polymer is diffusing, and so the monomer that you are looking at is also diffusing with the diffusion constant, which is the same as that of the whole polymer, and therefore scales as 1 over n. But there, before you reach that time, at intermediate times, if you follow the fluctuations of this tagged monomer, you will find that it is subdiffusing, and it has some related exponent, which is, again, smaller than
that's
one.
That's how people use correlation spectroscopy to try to extract what kind of dynamics is taking place inside the polymer, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's basically, again, the reason why the fact that what you are looking at is essentially the thing that is at the pore is really one monomer that belongs to the whole polymer. And in both cases, it's really the whole polymer and all of its different modes have to relax. That essentially makes this problem dynamically interesting and gives you these anomalous exponents.
So, because the solution, there is no such issue, right? Because the original problem, which was n squared, you have to compare to 3 nu in solution. And solution 3 nu is, even for swollen chain, is 1.8, which is lower. So, you're definitely, the first condition is satisfied if you look at dynamics.
Yeah.
So all of this is a sort of like a serious game for a particular Gauss model, which is really interesting, but it's not relevant to translocation solution.
Well, as I said, what you have to tell me, or what you have to convince me, is that your exponent of 1.8 or d nu for the hydrodynamics is valid when I take a polymer and put it on a surface.
No, but you said, I thought you were comparing motion in a mode which was moving through the hall, with
right.
the diffusion across the phantom plane without any wall.
For this particular case,
the argument is that diffusion
yes.
through the phantom plane was
right.
basically faster, and
right.
so you were worrying about
right.
Slower, but it right. actually in a case of dynamics, it is faster.
Yes.
And so you definitely have plenty of time to equilibrate on both sides. So
if no that is the relevant comparison.
Right. I agree right. with you. So yeah. so that if you're just doing this comparison of the realization right. time of the chain,
yeah,
the realization time of the chain is a slower process.
Right. But this, essentially what I am trying to do is, this is a simple case that I can indicate and show, and it gives you a warning that you have to treat the polymeric degrees of freedom carefully. I agree that the same reasoning, if I were to extend it to the case of the hydrodynamics, would not go through. But for the case of hydrodynamics, I don't know what the typical relaxation times are for a polymer that is grafted to a surface.
If you use scale, you can easily estimate it, because if F dynamic is self-similar, you take any section of chain of G monomers and ask, is are G monomers going to take translocation faster, which is G squared time, or relaxation of the particular section that is relevant for the particular mode is faster, which is G to the power 3 nu and G squared?
No, G to the 3 nu is for a polymer that is in solution.
Yes.
What is it for a polymer that is grafted to a surface?
I think the time, relaxation time right. Of a chain was, that is repelled from the surface,
yes.
it is basically wiggling here, scales the same way as relaxation time of the chain in solution. There is no scaling effect on that.
Well, I don't know.
The mobility at a surface goes to zero. You have lubrication.
Huh? This is Z motion, I'm sorry. So there is no coupling of... Well, I'm not sure what
okay, but in the Z motion...
Zero. So you have at least a two-scale function. It depends on two entries, a scaling
right.
function.
It's Brownian motion, it's not flow.
Still the mobility goes to zero.
Well, let's...
Okay. Why you continue with this?
Yeah. Okay. So now let's go to the case where you actually try to pull the polymer through. Now, in the experimental situation, the way that they do it is by applying a voltage, which essentially gives a different, in some sense, chemical potential to the monomers to be on one side or the other side, and it is this chemical potential difference that is pulling it through. You could also imagine the case where you actually grab hold of the first monomer and you try to pull it through. And essentially, in the case where there is a chemical potential difference, then there is a bias. You take the potential that you had and you tilt it. And once you have a tilted potential, there is going to be, if you go through this formalism where you were essentially looking at S dot being the change in free energy, you would conclude that there is a velocity that is proportional to your chemical potential difference. And then in order to pull something of length n, the amount of time that you have to wait is proportional to the length divided by that chemical potential difference. There is some modification of that you can do for applying a force, and again, for people who think about scaling in polymers, the dependence on force is nonlinear, but that's not particularly that important.
So you assume the friction is still monomeric. There is no velocity dependence on the friction. You're not assuming the friction is. There is no velocity dependence enough.
Or if you like, for sufficiently small velocities, it is an analytic function, so you can expand it and you look at the first step.
But it doesn't go to zero.
Yeah. If it went to zero, you would need to modify the previous formulation also. So this is a natural generalization.
So this one here, where you're pulling by a chemical potential,
yes.
proportional.
Okay.
That's some kind of purely viscous limit. I'm not sure.
Okay, so let's go through this free energy picture that we had. So previously we had the entropic potential, but suppose that there is a chemical potential difference. So then S monomers on this side will give you a contribution to free energy, which is mu plus S, and then you would have mu minus N minus S. So there is already a term in the energy that is mu plus minus mu minus times S.
By chemical potential, you mean the work of moving one ground block from left to right.
Right. Which,
as if it's disconnected with everything else.
That's right. Which is also what would happen if you had a chemical potential and you were pulling DNA through, because you were would be transporting charge across.
But in case of DNA, isn't there an electric force that deforms it, and so relaxation modes would be changed because of it actually gets elongated?
It doesn't matter. The amount of work that you do in transporting a charge from one end to the other end will be...
But the relaxation time changes to...
Well, in particular, it would be Rouse-like. It would make Rouse-like the approximation. If you stretch this thing out, then you have a pretty good approximation of what you have.
Rouse is a very good description for DNA dynamics.
So what happens if...
When stretch?
If the chemical potential isn't nice and directional, but just to say...
It's linear in the sea.
If you just have some ionic force rather than an electrical potential, so you no longer have any directionality, is there going to be, you're talking about a linear molecule through, what about a random chain? Is there any differences?
You're talking about random chains?
Not branched, but.
I'm talking about the random chain and a potential which is linear in Z, not just a step function. So you have electric force that pulls it, which means that potential is like linear. It elongates the chain.
Okay, but let's stick to this picture. And now what I would like to say is that, again, these pictures sound very reasonable. You have a chemical potential difference. You extend it on one side. There's a linear dependence on S. You think about the bounds that I was talking about last time, you'll find some difficulties. And in particular, if you imagine that what you want to do is to pull a polymer by a distance, again, of the order of its size, even when the wall was not there, well, it should be shorter than this. Well, let's see. What you need to do is to, the time would be the typical size of the polymer in a force divided by the velocity that the polymer would attain once you apply the force. The velocity that the polymer attains is the force divided by its mobility, or the which goes like 1 over, the mobility goes like 1 over n. So the velocity of the longer polymer for the same force would be proportionately smaller. The typical size roughly will be of the order of n. There's some modifications due to the force. But roughly this scaling is now n squared, again inconsistent with the n that we have up there.
Let's see, what
the force is linear in here? This here is a blob type of model.
Is force constant or force linear in ionic? If you have a charged polymer and every monomer feels a field, force will be proportional to n as well, right?
Yeah. No, this is the situation that I described over here. Constant when you take the first monomer. That's right. You just grab hold of it. Yeah.
Sorry, something's big enough or small enough.
Right. Okay.
So if I'm pulling a really stiff polymer, it's a little bit different behavior, obviously.
Yeah, that's actually a good limit. So imagine that you have a stiff polymer that is like a rod.
Yeah.
You grab hold of the first monomer with the force F, and you try to pull it. Okay?
Right.
So the length of the polymer is N. So the velocity that it will get will scale like F over N. If it is a longer polymer.
Well, depending if the assumption here is that the drag is all along the polymer.
Yes, that's right.
That's
right.
The whole difference here. Yeah.
That's right.
So it basically is this one.
Yeah.
Not this one.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And in that case.
Then it's.
So whereas this forgetting, assuming equilibrium, etc., you would say it goes like N. And similarly, you can make an argument for the case where you have a chemical potential difference And there, the exponent that we get, again, I won't go over the details, is larger than n. It is n to the 1 plus nu being the radius of gyration exponent. So again, we thought that this was inconsistent enough to go and do some simulations. And so we did some simulations in which we either exerted the force at one end, and you can see that when you pull at one end in one side, it becomes kind of stretched. On the other side, it kind of becomes crunched at the end. And it is these kinds of effects, again, if you want to think in terms of pictorially, you pull on one end, it becomes stretched, at the other end, it becomes crunched, and you have to relax things, etc., in order to be able to pull further. And once you include all of those effects, you find...
Why is it becoming crunched? Being stretched on the one side...
Actually, you are... quite right. I shouldn't have said crunched. It actually probably becomes over. There's probably, if you think about it as a cloud that is in equilibrium, you start to pulling it, and so the region that is close to the hole is probably less dense than it should be, and the other region is probably larger.
Should I think that I have instantaneous configuration and I pull out material, so I'm
right,
winding it out? Or should I imagine that all the time is able to at least partially re-equilibrate and it keeps looking like itself, avoiding random walk on the left side? Or you're pulling it out, right? You're thinning out the existing
So we start with a situation where we put the first monomer out here. We equilibrate the polymer on this side before we apply the force.
Yeah.
So we have a typical equilibrated configuration. Then we apply the force on the first monomer on this side and essentially do our molecular dynamics, etc., and track how many...
I'm only trying to...
Yeah.
The qualitative picture, I imagine one limit where it all the time keeps looking like itself, avoiding random walk.
Right.
So I would look at the statistics of the remaining part.
No.
Or it stays basically the snapshot of the initial configuration and I just jank it out from that initial configuration.
It can't be the latter, because for a monomer that was here, it has to reach to the hole.
Yeah.
And then it's going to pull everybody else, and everybody else has to rearrange.
There's an inner part that gets stretched, and the outer part gets almost in curve, and you can do the scaling of the cell. Deformation propagates out as you move. So I think you're keep stretching the inner part, and the length propagates out as you keep toying. So have you done statistical analysis of this?
No. We were interested just to sort of look at the scaling of the characteristic times, and we found in one case that an exponent that was, so here we had 1.9, our bound was n squared, so presumably it has to somehow get to n squared, and in the other case our bound was 1 plus nu, so it would have been 1.34. And the numerics is still not there, but they are certainly larger than linear. And this is, I guess, a configuration where we had a chemical potential difference.
Like a fluctuation dissipation theorem left, because here you mentioned the friction coefficient. And previously you argued about the, well, whatever it can call it, substitution coefficient. Is there a relationship between them?
I don't know. We couldn't find anything.
We have the form of the chain problems that can't be
dissipation.
You're way out of equilibrium.
So, essentially, the only thing...
Very slowly, but it's not initial linear vision. But you're going faster than the relaxation time, so you cannot...
Yeah. So the only thing that we have on the theoretical front is these bounds. So we say remove the ball, calculate by how long it takes as a function of n, it should take at least that long. So those are the only things that we have on the theoretical front. And our simulations didn't quite get to that bond. There have been, this was a few years ago, there have been more simulations by other people that seem to be more consistent with the bonds that we provide. So just to sort of, again, indicate that there is this problem. So
those limits are the times based on preaching and moving
up. Yeah. Okay. So another issue that Shura mentioned in his talk is one of the more recent experiments that the group of Meller and company did, where they looked at the asymmetry in the times that it takes for the DNA to go through the pore, arising from the fact that you start by putting the 3 prime end into the pore or the 5 prime end into the pore. And again, the procedure is that they can put a hook on one side of the polymer, which cannot be pulled. Initially, they apply a strong voltage so that the thing is in a configuration like this when it is trapped. At that point, they turn off the current, they turn off the voltage, so that this thing freely can go back and forth, and they can monitor the amount of time that this polymer stays inside the pore. And they find that depending on whether it enters with the 3 prime end or the 5 prime end, the distribution of the times to still be in the pore after a time t is different. And so as they point out, and Shura also mentioned in his talk, the DNA is an asymmetric molecule. It has some directionality to it. The pore that they look at also has some shape to it and directionality. And so you can imagine two configurations that are symmetrically unrelated. And indeed, by putting the 3 prime end or the 5 prime end, they were looking at these two symmetrically unrelated configurations, so it's not surprising that they get two different times. But what would be interesting is, yes?
Which goes faster, 5 prime or 3 prime? I didn't catch that.
3 prime is the top one, 5 prime is the bottom one. So we see that the chances that at some time here, 5 prime is still in the pore is less than 3 prime.
It's a funny looking curve. I mean, it sort of looks like, you know, if there's a normalization problem, they look identical. The longer time depends
right.
Looks identical.
Yeah, the tails are the.
Is there really something going on in the dash region, that dash region with no data?
I don't know. There is one point.
If that one point is the normalization, then
yeah,
there may not.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know.
Do you have a distribution from your simulation of peak probability of stay versus time?
I'll come to that. Our distributions are exponential. So
it doesn't have any plateaus like this?
No.
On a log scale, it's weird.
Books, they also give in the text of the paper, they also provide average values of these times,
mm-hmm.
and averages, according to their claims, are different by almost a factor of 2.
Yeah, that's right.
Could this characteristic time scale have to do with the forming of and unforming of additional loops, that is transient secondary structure, which you have to wait for in order to...
Poly A is really, really stacked.
Yeah.
It's almost, it looks like a half.
Okay, is this poly A?
Poly A, yes. And actually, in this paper, you can see that Klaus Schulten is a co-author, and Schulten did atomistic simulations. And so their explanation for what is happening is that the bases have to be kind of more stacked or angled when they are in the pore, and that's really the difference.
Yes, sir, yes.
The position, the fact that the 5' end has phosphate all the way at the very end is not having any effect, or not, shouldn't have any effect here?
Could be. I
just
don't know.
Just how fast it, I would think would have an effect on how fast you find the pore.
I guess one way to check that, and I guess related to other things that we will be seeing, is to change the length of the polymer, because the effect that you are mentioning is one monomer out of n, and so if they can see how it scales with n, that would be fine.
Can you move the figure out so we can see
the case? Are those dash curves supposed to be some theoretical curves?
No.
I think they may come from the simulations, actually. I don't know if you remember.
So why are there two times?
Let's see. We can go and take
a short regime and a long regime.
You have an explanation.
Yeah, I do.
So what's next?
What does it
look like? Now it's clear.
Let's get to the figure. All right.
Fit to the diamond.
Solid lines represent non-exponential fits to the data. Dashed lines are fit to the data according to the model discussed in the text, so that there is some kind of theoretical model.
With two time scales.
Okay. Now, the thing that they didn't do, and as Shura pointed out, would be interesting, would be that they would try to enter with the same end from the two sides of the pore. So essentially, what they looked at was two situations that were symmetrically unrelated. It would be interesting to put the loop or the stopper either at the one end or the same end of one of these configurations, so that when you are performing unbiased diffusion, you don't know, essentially, when you're in the middle of a long polymer, it shouldn't make any difference whether or not the stopper is at one end or at the other end. And the interesting thing is that even under that circumstance, it is possible to see a difference between the translocation times. And I guess the way that Shura in his paper does it is essentially he considers a sawtooth potential essentially representing things that are easy and hard and easy, hard and easy to pull through, and calculates a difference between the mean first passage time from one end to the other end. We had done a similar version where we essentially did a hopping problem. We said that let's imagine that you want to hop from one end to another end through a sequence of steps that are either hard, easy, hard, easy, hard, easy. And then you ask, if you start at this end, what is the mean of the first time that you get to the other end? And what you find is that the mean time is typically diffusive, goes like n squared, if you have to go n steps. The diffusion constant is 1 over the product of these two. But on top of that, the mean first passage time has a linear component, n, that is either 1 over p if you start from one end, or 1 over q if you start from the other end. So although diffusion is symmetric, there is nothing in thermodynamics that says that the first passage times should be symmetric. And in this case, the difference will occur at order of one order in n smaller. So our prediction that we haven't tested yet is that if we go to the limit where we are doing rather than regular diffusion, if we go and do this thing with this subdiffusive behavior, the time difference rather than scaling as n on top of the n squared, the difference being of the order of n, will be somewhat larger of the order of n to the 2 nu, because it probably is bounded by the times that it would take to go from here or here, because starting from the middle is somewhat like the other situation of going across. So this is a prediction to be tested. So finally, I want to end.
Is there a physical argument to this? So it's not the end effect.
It is an end effect.
So can you repeat why?
You see, so suppose that you have something that is n squared to leading behavior, but because of the end, you really aren't starting at n, but maybe at n minus 1/2 or n plus 1/2, and you expand this.
Absolutely.
And you get a correction that is of the order. Yeah.
But then you said something else at the next line.
Oh, okay.
Saying that it's not one over n, but it's something else.
Okay, because this assumed that you had diffusive transport, so that the time that it took would be n squared. Now, we said previously that the time actually is not n squared, but n to the 2 nu plus 1. So you put 1 over n of that.
So the total correction is 1 over n.
Yeah.
It's a correction to Schur's correction.
No, it's the same thing.
That's different from what you had. That's what I mean with the correction to your correction.
Now, the other thing that was in Schur's paper, and my collaborator Yakov Kantor has been doing all of this and does the simulations, and he was incensed about that, was that in their paper, Schur said that actually whenever you have subdiffusive dynamics, people say that if you look at the time to escape, you'll find that it has such large power law tails that if you try to calculate the mean amount of time that it takes to pass, it will be infinite. And so this really worried Yakov, because he said, well, what did I calculate if Schur says that what I calculated does not have any meaning? So he got very upset about this, so this started us thinking about...
interpretation.
Yes, but the interpretation was according to waiting until you have measured something or other, which is not exactly what Yakov had done.
But it depends on the exponent of the power law.
No. Once you are subdiffusive, so x squared goes with a power of t that is less than 1, the claim is that the distributions have long tails, the mean goes to infinity. Okay? Now, that statement comes from what I would be happy to review for anybody who has energy left, which is the concept of fractional diffusion equation, generalizing diffusion equations to things that have anomalous dynamics. And they really come from thinking about continuous time random walks, which is basically rather than the standard random walk that you stand somewhere and then you go to the right or to the left with some probability, you stand somewhere and after some distribution in time, you decide to now it's time to go to the right or to the left, where the amount of time that you stand somewhere is itself power law distributed. So you could potentially be standing there for a very, very long time before you jump. So your time has been ticking all the way forward. So it's not surprising that you go in a certain amount of time, fewer number of steps. So we can go through the mathematics of it, but that's really essentially what these continuous time random walks do and how they manage to get these kinds of things. But that is really at the heart of it, both this equation that people work with and this process that I described with waiting and then jumping, essentially taking a series of uncorrelated steps where your fifth step is independent of all your previous steps, etc. And that's one of the reasons that you are actually able to analytically solve this problem, whereas that's not the case for us. Yes.
If I take your philosophy literally,
yeah,
shouldn't the same thing be true for plain old hydrodynamics? If I have a wall and I have a little channel, mm-hmm. and there's a few molecules trying to move back and forth. If they really want to get out of the channel, they have to wait for equilibration. There has to be space. They can push there, but all the other water molecules on the other side have to move out of the way. Won't I get the same argument that I would get subdiffusive behavior of the molecule? Or there's any kind of conservation? Whenever I transport coupled to conservation law, your argument seems to assume to say that I have to wait for an ever-growing equilibration time on either side in order to get through. Or am I wrong?
No, it's the problem aspect that gave you this ever-increasing time.
But why not?
No. Yeah.
Same thing.
That's right. So you in hydrodynamics, for you have these velocity distributions that have long power law tails and slow types of things. I'm not sure what that implies about
so
whether.
You wouldn't get diffusion if you take a channel between two volumes of copper filled with water, and I look at the molecules in the channel. Will it be diffusive or not?
Will what?
The motion of the water molecules in a pore. No, it's not a pore. Sorry.
Yeah.
If I use the same logic, because if I move on the right side, I increase the pressure.
Who gives you this analog of these very long relaxation times? I mean, it's true that in hydrodynamics you have things like long time tails and
exactly.
So forth, but
if I'm trying to enter one of the two if a small number of molecules try to enter one of the two reservoirs, then there has to be a hydrodynamic relaxation or a viscous relaxation on either side.
Yeah, but
what plays the role of the length of the polymer?
The size of the reservoir.
No, but that's relatively fast. There are small remaining correlations, but I mean,
yeah.
As you know, they're hard to measure. Really
well,
small.
If you take two dimensions, then it's not so small. That long.
Okay, so dimensionality can make it bigger, but it's. I think
it's
the amplitude is
quite small. We're not talking about amplitudes, but whether fundamentally it's diffusive or not.
But let's keep that as a separate discussion. So coming back to this particular problem, so it is true that we established that for the translocation coordinate you have subdiffusive behavior. But the way that it has become subdiffusive is not by undergoing this process of continuous time waiting. It is because of all of the other degrees of freedom. So there is no reason in our mind that it should be described by the same type of equation that people have used. So we actually went and simulated a very similar process, not exactly the same thing. So what we did was we went to another example, which is that if you pick a monomer that we tag inside a polymer and follow the motion of that tagged monomer, as we discussed, that would be subdiffusive. And we can start it at some location and see how long it takes to reach some other point and calculate the distribution of this first passage time. And what we found was that if we make the length of the polymer longer and longer, so it becomes more and more in the subdiffusive regime, eventually the distribution becomes a nice exponential tail.
Can you explain why the two processes give a different waiting before I stab or having a correlation that basically effectively giving the same as square displacement, why is it any different? I mean, if I'm looking,
why are they the same?
Because the actual trajectories, if I look in square displacement or correlation time.
No. The actual trajectory, if you follow the, I showed you for this translocation coordinate, it was something that was fluctuating in time more or less uniformly. For the continuous time random walk, what you find is that you have long intervals that you are standing and then you jump and then long intervals. So if you look at the trace of that random process, it doesn't look anything like the traces.
You can get the same interval.
For the one quantity, which is the average fluctuations, delta S squared as a function of time, both of them are a subdiffusive process. But there are lots and lots of different processes that in principle would agree on that one particular measure of their fluctuations, but not necessarily on others.
Should I understand that probability distribution of displacement as a function of time would be different in two scenarios.
For the for the trajectories as a function of time.
If I start with delta function and look at probability distribution of where I get, it's going to be
different. Absolutely, yes, yes.
Well, so second indeed, moment is the same.
Yeah, while the second moment is the same. And indeed, that's what happens. That is, for these continuous time random walks, the distributions develop these power law tails. And for these, this particular thing, one can show that the distribution is a nice Gaussian. It's just the variance that changes anomalously. So anyway, basically, this is just for the expert that there is nothing infinite in the mean mean first passage time for this type of polymeric subdiffusive process. But it is there for the case of the fractional random walks, and basically, unless you really want me to go and give a tutorial about fractional Brownian motion, that's what I wanted to say. And the outline is also a summary. It basically showed that thinking about the relaxation of the whole polymer means that there are scaling phenomena as a function of length that render the dynamics somewhat non-trivial, and you have to think about that and incorporate those degrees of freedom into your description of the whole process. Thank you.
Yeah. Could you go back to the Mellor experiments?
Sure.
I'm really intrigued. Because your argument about this, and I guess yours as well, about what was it, these first passage times gets a correction, one over n relative correction.
Right, right.
Two directions. But it sort of looks like, if I look at that, it looks like the, not only are there two time scales, but the two time scales are the same in each one, and the only difference is the relative amounts of the two modes, so to speak.
Okay, well, first of all, the experimental situation is different from the theory that Shura and I developed, because they correspond to these two symmetrically unrelated situations. So forget about
it. Is that
two symmetrically unrelated situations is exactly what corresponds to these two directions of?
No. One of them, if let's say this is the wide end of the hole, let's say the bad part is trying to go through the wide part, this is the good part. So there's no reason why the diffusion constant should be the same in the two cases. So in principle, symmetry allows you to have two totally different curves here with no scaling in it.
I agree with that, but the argument seems to be about characteristic times.
Right.
Change by amount 1 over n.
Right.
If I look at this, it looks like the characteristic times may be the same. Certainly the dash curves suggest that. Yeah, so obviously we have to look at the model, but
right.
But it doesn't look like time constants has changed, just relative amounts of two different.
Well, the time constants in this curve would presumably be the slope. So clearly at the beginning, they see two different slopes. Here you don't see any slope. And
well,
then
no, the decay occurs on the same time scale. It's linear log as opposed to log linear.
Right, so it's a little hard.
It's wrong axis. Mm-hmm. It's a little hard to read what an exponential would look like there.
Could it be you have a same person you multiply with that and get the same person? Because it's like twice, for small time, it's about three times, four times, for large times.
I don't know. It just looks to me like if I were to pick characteristic times out of that, those two curves, they look basically the same.
Yes.
It seems, I would really just say there's two sort of populations, one which gets out very quickly, exactly.
Yeah.
And then there's another one which is more convoluted, and they are characterized by a time scale of about 10 to the 4, which seems to be the same for the 3 prime and prime.
But you have the theoretical arguments here.
But it's not for the wrong scale, not for this case, it's for a different model.
The theoretical argument is probably just for the initial effect that the initial part behavior is given.
No, it's first passage time.
Is it?
It's just
Niran, would you believe that the argument of you and Shura applies to the early time, the escape of the
I guess our argument would give distributions that are nice pure exponentials.
Yes.
Right. So
can you get the initial part to exponential? Is it semi log scale?
The initial one or the late or the long one? So long.
I would expect the initial one actually.
But you have half the population until that long time in the upper case.
Yes.
Average time is going to be limited by the tail, not by the image.
Anyway, it's a very
You can read the paper.
In the preceding set of overheads, you compared simulations where you were pulling the polymer out to where you just had a chemical potential pulling one bead at a time.
Right.
And then different sorts of can you run back to that?
Sure.
To the non-physicist.
So you look at transport of a one-dimensional channel.
I
can stay with it.
That simulation and the next set of simulations.
Right. So the next simulation is when there is a chemical potential.
It's a chemical potential, and so both sides are essentially random. This side is not straight.
Right.
I don't understand these graphs here.
Okay.
So brief bit of background. I'm not a physicist. I'm a biochemist.
Okay, so what we did was, it's good to sort of go back and think about the simulation. So again, the polymer starts with its first monomer here.
Yes.
And every time a monomer goes from one end to another end, there is a gain in chemical potential.
Right.
So the polymer that is at the pore will get experiences a force that is pushing it to one side. The ones that are here or here, they don't experience any force except for what is transmitted to them by.
So these are trying to equilibrate whether or not they're able to make it. It doesn't really matter. This one's has a bit more deal. A bit more of a problem for equilibrium, so stuff is coming in at the same time.
Right.
And because it has to push against all of this material here, that's impeding the.
On one side here, okay, so I guess the difference between this. And this is that on this side, it doesn't experience a clustering of material, whereas here, indeed, if it wants to go through here, it has to push away some of the particles that are here.
So the graphs you have here, force over kT, I don't know what the...
And here it's the typical time that it took to go across, scaled with some appropriate power of the length.
Okay.
So that's
so here it's somewhere in the ballpark. 0.05 after with about 2 kT of force, 3 kT of force in the next one.
If you allow this exchange, then it'll effectively mix
is it
together.
Any it's much
if you allow single particle diffusion, the collector will be
so this is going basically much, much slower. Why is it going? Here you have
density variation.
The chemical potential is essentially the energy difference to be here or there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's scaled by kT. So beta is 1 over kT. So that's dimensionless. Now the time has been scaled with some power of n.
Mm-hmm.
So the power of n here is different from the power of n that we have here.
Okay.
So this power is larger.
But is it,
I agree that if I allow random exchange process, then
essentially dimensionless way. That scaling factor is wonderful.
Yeah.
And in the next one, you show your scaling factor is wonderful. If you had a different,
exponent, exactly,
they wouldn't overlay.
Yes.
So nicely.
That's right.
So that's, it's an appropriate scaling factor.
Right. Right. And so let's go back to the.
If you were to look at the raw data.
Yes.
Without scaling it.
I would argue that you have to wait.
These are just going to be slower.
Right hand side from the left hand side of transport.
Aren't they?
Yes, because the opposite. Because you see, in the one case, tau goes like with a larger power of n, like 2 plus 1.9 or something. Here it goes like n to 1.7 or something, 1.5. So for sufficiently large, this takes longer than this. And actually,
yeah, something you get. So
the rate limiting step, I believe, is equilibrating the stretched object.
The stretched object?
The stretched object.
This part here. I think this part that slows you down.
No.
Yeah,
because the n squared comes from that part. See, if you go to the argument, see where the n squared comes. It comes
from where?
The stretched part.
Line? Where is it? Why does it say stretched, not the other part? Where does it say that it's stretched in your argument?
In that the radius is proportional to n.
If it is already stretched. But r proportional to n everywhere. It doesn't. Your friction doesn't care, or the radius.
If it is already stretched.
Right. But you see, when we start with our initial configuration, this part is not proportional to n.
Right.
This part is much smaller.
So stretching it here from a smaller to proportional to n is the main step. This is the part that you're deforming. This part already deformed. There is nothing to relax. This is by a rod.
Yeah.
This is a rod and it's not relaxing. What you're really doing is you're taking something here which was a fractal,
right,
and you're deforming a fractal into a rod here. So that's where all of the deformation and process occurs. I mean, you can write up a very simple scaling theory for how this occurs in this tail. This is where all the friction is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that you pull with very strong force, such
yes.
that this is completely straight.
Right.
Then there is nothing to relax here.
There is, I think
something where this gets to be very important is understanding ejection of that's what Ian will be talking about, but also in any of these experiments that are measuring single molecules of nucleic acid being pulled in or pulled out, because you're dealing with normally it's a chemical problem. But when you do a Bustamante single molecule
right.
experiment with tweezers,
that's
very different polymers on either side.
Yeah, we had a paper with Dejean exactly on this model. We are pulling the chamber at the end through the gel. There was a stretched part and a relaxed part. And the relaxed part was doing all the friction as this thing was pulling through. So it was basically divided. We call it a plume model, where you have And so this was like an end parachute. We call this parachute.
Okay.
Because here you're just pulling out in your gun. There, it was getting from one gear to another because it was sort of a steady state. So we solved for the steady state because it was a gel and it was deformed.
It was being pulled by one end and
through the gel.
Yeah. Okay.
So
as gel was essentially just a barrier like this.
But there was a continuous set of barriers. So you had one here and here and it was everywhere. And so there was a relaxed part that was putting all the friction in, and this part was basically going for the ride.
Right.
And this is different because you're deformed here and undeformed there, but that's where all the friction is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we actually did recently similar estimate with Nechayev, exactly with the problem with this hole, and our result was also that it's mostly here.
Uh-huh.
It's like my image for that, if you want to eat
very long spaghetti, then the difficulty is before your lips.
I didn't think about this.
The last part of which probably I am the most interested person is that on your website. I know you told me some time ago that your talks are there. Should I look at
it? But it's only that one transparency. Yes, it is on the web, but it's only the one transparency that I showed here, so I can show it.
Show it to me.
So,
Miran, I'd really love to talk to you about this section. If you're still around, say tomorrow or Friday.
I'm around.
Because this is something that I'm really interested in. Because this is different from what we did, because it's going from a coil to some stretch. And how it is get deformed as it gets in. Because this part is boring, but that part is interesting.
Right. So if we can do better than
because the scaling,
barriers.
We can go do a simple scaling estimate of how it deforms.
Right.
And I don't know the answer, but it's, since you have the data, you can check it.
That is what we try to do with HIF.
You have an answer? Okay.
Yeah, I think we have an answer.
So we can
meet
three of us and see whether this answer agrees with the data.
Okay.
So what we did here was the following. We had an interval in one dimension, and we started with a polymer of length n, where the middle monomer was the one that we were interested.
Okay.
Basically, it's all one dimensional. It's a phantom polymer.
Okay.
And
polymer lives in one dimension.
Yes.
But it's Rouse polymer.
Rouse polymer. Yes. Please do. Yes, I should.
Thank you.
Yeah. So essentially, it's very easy to show that the expectation value of x squared goes like t to the 1/2, and the probability distribution, if we didn't have the boundaries, would be Gaussian with t to the 1/2.
Right.
So it's perfectly well behaved when you look at this coordinate.
Right.
So what we did was we ask when this coordinate first reaches one end or the other.
I see. Okay? And that is the result.
And that's the result.
For phantom case?
Phantom. So completely you can do a lot of things analytically. Okay. This probability distribution is analytical, etc. But the first passage time.
That part I believe. Yeah. But if it's fractal, I don't see recovery. I don't see why I should. If this whole thing is supposed to be fractal, like if you have a swollen chain.
Right.
Are you really recovering Gaussian, or are you recovering some other power law, which is Gaussian-like, but has a anomalous exponent here?
I'll answer that later.
I'm trying to see whether the distribution. I'm interested in the distribution you're getting. You're starting from in the middle.
Right.
You're doing this anomalous diffusion by with correlations.
Yeah.
Like Rouse or swollen or something.
Yeah, let's say Rouse. Yeah.
No Rouse, but let's say I have a swollen chain. So your tau is n to the 1 plus 2 nu, not square.
But you see already
for square I can see by Gaussian's kind, but is this distribution as it gets broadened?
No, but we are not looking at translocation anymore. We are looking at the tagged monomer.
I'm looking at tag monomer,
right.
So I'm asking where the tag monomer
okay,
is.
So the tagged monomer, you agree, is subdiffusive.
Not with a half.
Yes.
Why is it a half if you're doing Rouse with?
No, that's translocation time.
What is x now?
This is the location of the tagged monomer.
A location along what?
Okay, so we have
a Rouse polymer that lives in one dimension.
You have a Rouse polymer that lives in one dimension.
You're going too fast for me.
Okay.
Go back to your language, from my language.
What?
Or my language to your language.
Okay, so we have one dimension. We have a polymer. Let's say this is monomer 0, this is monomer 1, monomer 2, monomer 3, monomer n.
What are we drawing now?
Just a random walk, a phantom polymer in
phantom
one dimension.
Phantom polymer, no issue.
Yeah.
I'm not asking about one dimensional phantom. I'm
that's what we simulated. So hear me out for the one dimensional phantom.
For the phantom, to get Gaussian.